long-term stuff, we want to make sure that we aren't at the mercy of this cell phone, this device that takes our attention. And when it takes our attention, then I'm saying yes to this phone and I'm saying no to Glennon, the human being sitting next to me. And I think that that will be a huge deathbed regret of a lot of people over the next 50 years. I think I spent more of the last 20 years of my life on the phone than I did in actual communication and interaction with real life people.
This is the Beautiful Writers Podcast. I'm Linda Sievertson, your host, and that was Abby Wambach, two-time Olympic gold medalist and two-time New York Times bestseller. Abby's first book, Forward, was a deeply personal memoir, and her new book, Wolfpack, is a rallying cry for letting go of the old rules and changing up the game. Abby's also known these days for the power of two in another arena, as her very public marriage to author and activist Glennon Doyle has captured the enthusiasm and adoration of millions of us who follow pretty much their every step on social media. In the old days, I think they would have called us stalkers. My guest host for this episode is bestselling author and O Magazine columnist Martha Beck, a great friend of this show and of Abby and Glennon. You may have heard Martha and I interview Glennon just before Love Warrior came out and exploded to number one and onto Oprah's book club list. To hear Abby talk about how that episode helped her fall in love with her future wife, that was just a total example of you never know who's listening. I love these reminders that when we do what we love, people often feel that love. This conversation took place just before Abby left for her book tour for Wolfpack, which was also on the third anniversary of her sobriety. Go, Abby. But I've been traveling too, so I have been aching to have the time to put this together for you guys. Good news, though, I think you're going to find this chat filled with topics you haven't heard Abby talking about on tour or maybe even anywhere, like her very best travel tips, because this gal has traveled endless miles, and how she and Glennon hibernate after a busy period to reconnect. I learned wonderful ideas for ditching my phone and connecting with my guy that you might also find helpful. Abby shares her mindset for overcoming internet trolls, the highs and lows of being a bonus mom, and a before and after moment that changed her life. If you ever find a TMZ camera in your face, well, have no fear. Oh, and we talk about college diplomas or the lack thereof, which is kind of a favorite topic of mine. Made all that much more interesting with a three-time Harvard degree recipient and professor here in Martha. Serena Williams calls Wolfpack a must-read and a manifesto. Yep, wholeheartedly agree. If you haven't read it yet, put it on your list now. Promise, you're gonna thank me. Thank you, as always, for tuning in and for being part of our podcast, Wolfpack. I would howl right now, but let's just start with welcome.
Linda, I'm so glad you're doing this. Thanks, babe.
Oh, are you kidding me? I love it. This podcast was the first time I was able to hear my wife really do her thing when I was falling in love with her. And I listened to her podcast with you and Martha like 10 times. And I don't know if you know this, Martha, but when I first met Glennon, you guys had done this podcast with her when her Love Warrior book was dropping. And we had spent many months apart because we both had to figure out our lives before we could come together.
Yeah.
And so during those months apart, your podcast was like a saving grace for me because it was the thing that I listened to like really know Glennon and get to know her more. So I have
a
love for this podcast beyond.
Oh, that's so great. I'm glad I was able to sit there and be in awe of Glennon.
I know, we were so in awe. We were just like gushing all over her.
Yeah. And Martha, you were the person that we called upon early on in our relationship because there was so much what felt like drama. And when we talked to you, you just said, live your love out loud. And that's basically the advice we keep coming back to in so many of our decisions. So yeah, thank you for that.
It's not like you guys wouldn't have done that anyway.
Yeah, but sometimes, especially women, sometimes we need permission to do things that feel instinctive.
Yeah.
And when you're in the fame world, things can get a little bit more confused and confusing. So to have the permission from somebody else is oftentimes the thing that can give us the courage to just go out and do what we felt like we wanted to do.
And now you guys are doing that for so many people. To watch your love affair unfold over these last couple of years has been so beautiful, and so many people have felt permission to be themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And it all started right here on this podcast.
Oh, goodness. And yeah, you know what's so weird about that? One of the most surreal things for me about the act of creating a book or a show like this is that you never know who your work is affecting. You just never have any clue.
Yep.
Yeah, Oprah actually just recently said something beautiful that really hit home for me. And so many people worry about their legacy and what their legacy will be. And she just simply said, your legacy is what goes beyond you. And so her show for 25 years or whatever, the people that she impacted, the millions and millions and maybe billions of people she has impact on, and she's not worried about her legacy. Like, her legacy is about what other people go then and do with whatever kind of art she's been able to create to influence and inspire people. So for me, that's what these podcasts are. I'm a podcast listener through and through. I listen to a few a day. So I think that that's really special.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you.
Is this a guy thing, this obsession with legacy? I think it's an ego thing.
I know that it's an ego thing. I have a few former teammates that have a mild obsession with what their ego is going to be. And we actually just went through this deep dive programming that one of these very women, she said, you know, I've been so worried about my legacy, but all the while I'm worried about my legacy. And your legacy is your life work. It's a daily consistent returning to your values and returning to the things that matter. And if you put all of your heart and emphasis into whatever you're doing, work or otherwise, that is a legacy that you'll always be proud of. So rather than having a picture of a legacy that you're trying to attain, that's like a reverse engineering that never really truly works. It's just like Glennon always says, in order to not have deathbed regret, ensure yourself not to have bedtime regret. And that's a value in our family.
That's so intense. My mother had some real deathbed regrets. Actually, my father did too. There's a weird balance, you guys. I think that people who are famous, oftentimes when they were little kids, they knew they were here to do something to touch many people. And so they're driven to do that, but it doesn't always make sense until you're older. When you know you're supposed to do something on a world stage, there is a sense of legacy that when you are on your deathbed, if you didn't do it, then there is so much regret. So I don't know. It's an interesting
question. Yeah, the number one thing that people say that causes them this deathbed regret is their ability to live their own lives. So many people, they find themselves at the end of their life realizing they have lived a different version of what they wanted to live, a life that they aren't fully proud of because it's not exactly what they wanted to do. Right. And if that isn't enough statistical evidence for people to stop whatever the fuck they're doing and do what they need to do and do what they're moved to do, whatever that means, that's the number one thing for me. Don't take a job just because it's making you money. That might serve some ego thing in you, but at the end of your life, whose life did you live? Did you live your own life, or did you live the life that somebody else wanted you to have or that you thought that you were supposed to be living?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a mistake to say it's all work, it's all kids. It's like if your destiny is to sit in a cave and meditate until you're enlightened, do that. If your destiny is to go be a sports star, do that. One size does not fit all here.
Totally.
No. So one of the ways this conversation feels a little like part two is that, like we did for G's Love Warrior, Abby, Martha and I are once again freaking out for a book in your family. So Wolfpack is so effing good. Good Lord. Right. And it's making me think, is there something in the water at your house? Is Naples, Florida built atop some magical rocks or something? What's going on?
It really is awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I sleep on a golden throne. I poop out golden nuggets No, I think it's just two people who have been doing our life work in separate arenas, but they all have arrows pointing in the right direction. And Glennon is a massive success in her world and in her art. And what we do is we talk all the time. I mean, you can imagine two women, we're both very feeling women and both very introspective about ourselves and about the world. And I think that because of that, the art that we create has been mined for so much of the gold that we look for that then gets created into the book that you've read and Glennon's art that she puts out into the world. Not that I have anything to really do with it, but I'm like the first reader. I'm the test case. I'm the test case dummy with Glennon. And so it's been a wonderful thing for me to step into being quote unquote an artist. I didn't really know that I had something to say. I didn't know that my soccer career would give me a level of experience to be able to create a book.
Or two. Forward was a big book, a very raw and emotional memoir.
Yeah, I promised myself I would never do it again after the first one because it was such a brutal process. But this one was more or less organically created. The speech happened in last May at Barnard, and because of that, and because of the response that we got from it, we were able to kind of push forward and to create new ideas inside the book, but also touch on the things that I talked about in the speech. And I'm very proud of it. I think that I have needed Glennon to be in my life as my mirror, because there are things that I do on a daily basis that she points at, and she's like, look, you do it this way. And not many women know that. What you just did, most yeah. women don't know. And so unpacking some of the daily interactions that I have with my own life and having a person like Glennon who's pretty good at spotting newness and difference, she has allowed me the access to understanding myself more and has given me more access to be able to write something and to be able to create what is essentially art. And, you know, I didn't even realize as an athlete, I was also an artist on some level, being out on the field and pushing my body. Those are the things that she's been able to kind of show me and walk me into a newer, beautiful, better version of myself that was, I guess, always there, but I just never had the language to be able to put myself in that quote-unquote box.
Well, and also you're kind of talking about how when you're really hyper-successful in one area, it does transfer. Those skill sets can be transferred to other areas of life, can't they?
Yes. So I think that that's probably one of the most important things that she was able to show me, because I think a lot of women can understand the whole idea of imposter syndrome and feeling like a fraud, especially the few women that get offered a seat at the table or are given a high-level managing CEO position at a company. There's a feeling like, how did I break through this? How did I achieve this kind of success? So when I retired from playing, there was definitely a lot of conversations in our house about that specific thing where I was a soccer player. I had the total identity as a soccer player. I was badass at playing soccer. I achieved everything that I possibly could as an athlete, as a soccer player. And what she made me aware of is that soccer didn't make me special. What I am and my soul and my being and everything that I brought to soccer is what made soccer special. And everybody has access to that. And everybody, no matter what it is you do, you have access to make whatever you're doing special. It's just you have to actually have the invitation to understand and maybe the language to understand you yourself are special and you get to bring yourself everywhere you go. I didn't just take off this costume of soccer player. I, Abby, am still the same person, and whatever I do, whatever I get to be a part of, I'm bringing my full self to, and that is what makes it special, not the other way around.
Abby, I loved your story about trying sports casting and how you basically had, I'm sure you were amazing, but to you it was like a face plant or something. I'm sure it wasn't that bad, but there's something called a meta skill, which is like every language you learn, it becomes easier to learn any language. So the more great skills you have, the more ability to be great at things is transferred to other places. So you tried sports casting and you were like, I don't think so. But then you immediately pivoted to the stuff you're doing now, which is basically activism and consciousness raising for women. And it's a great example of failing forward, but it's also so interesting how you found the thing you didn't want, and then instead of trying to be better at it, you switched to something that felt more inherently great for you. And it was kind of like knowing how a game is moving. And I wish all of us could have that skill. So can you tell us how you did that?
Yeah, I think making failure fuel has been something that has been kind of building, and I've been learning this skill for my whole career. And it is a learned skill, by the way. I don't think that people generally fail, and the first time that they've ever fallen down or they failed at something, they're like, okay, I'm going to make this the best thing that ever happened to me. You have to go through it to understand what it means, and you have to get to the other side of often one of these big failures of your life to know that you can get through to the other side. That's why heartbreak is so important for people. That's why failure is so important, because it's a learned skill to be able to use it to your benefit. And I think that this going to work with ESPN and being over there in Paris, the number one thing that I realized, because this was the trajectory of most former professional athletes who are capable of speaking their mind and who reached a certain level of fame or popularity inside of their sport. This is the next step. This is the most common step. And so I was like, all right, this is great. And ESPN, they paid me a lot of money to work for them and to do this. And I thought, all right, well, we'll just see about it. We'll give this a shot. That being said, I didn't understand how much preparation went into commentating. I did not understand that I didn't know much about the men's international game in terms of the players and knowing the background of some of these guys. Though I loved playing for Team USA for many years, soccer isn't something that I'm like, oh, I can't wait to watch the game. I didn't grow up watching soccer. I grew up playing soccer. Those are very different things. So I found myself, the red light turned on, and it's like everything that I knew about myself as a human being, it's like it all went out the window. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. And I think that if it didn't go quite as badly, I probably would have tried to keep doing it. I probably would have went back and continued down that road. But I'm also really keen on knowing what I like and what I don't like. And a part of the commentating world that I loathe is that it's inherently critical. So the energy and my perspective of watching this game and trying to analyze this game for viewers has to be done in a very critical mindset. And that is not my nature. I'm very positive. I'm very optimistic. And so that's something that they were trying to coach me at becoming more like. And that's not something that I want to become. Right. So because of all of these reasons, number one, I was a rookie. I sucked at it, which is super normal. There's no reason why I should have been good at it. And then number two, I decided from like a bigger moral perspective, all of my output, I wanted to be about love and about positivity and about creating real positive change. And I just didn't see a long-term plan that would allow me to achieve that kind of success. So the pivot is what's the most important part of the story, because sometimes we find ourselves in the same life or in the same mistake or the same problem because you've made this one decision and the signs of your life, you're not reading right. So you're either getting sick or the world is just not opening up to you. That is a big sign that maybe you're not doing the life work or you're not on the life path that you need to be on. And because I have such a great passion for wanting to change the world in a positive way, especially for women, I did some real digging and I figured out a specific way I wanted to do it. The failures of my life are the things that allowed me the ability to say, okay, nope, I don't want to do that. I'm going to go do this over here. And I'm very focused and I'm very attention oriented. So because of that, because, you know, you run into an obstacle, the obstacle is perfect information, right? Like when things happen, that is just information gathering. And the more information you gather around a certain topic or a job or whatever you want your purpose to be, and it's not going into the path of least resistance, it's going into the path of where your self-esteem is going to, and the way you feel about yourself and the way that you think about yourself is going to be your highest, most beautiful version.
I think that's right. When I was going through a rough time early in my career, my sister said to me, Linda, go back to what comes easy. Where does it flow for you? And flowing for me was always with book proposals. I always had just a kind of a clear idea about how to sell people. It was really easy for me. And she said, when things get tough, just go back to that. And that's where my joy was. And then everything good came back from that.
Yeah.
So the idea of soccer for Glennon, I've talked with you both and we've shared some pretty funny stuff. And Glennon's been on a couple of times. Other than when Martha and I interviewed her, she was on with Van Jones as my guest co-host and Anne Lamott. And so I feel like I know her sense of humor pretty well, but she can still come out of left field and make me laugh so hard. Like when she recently shared that she had no idea, even having been married to a soccer player, even though her kids were soccer players, like no idea that soccer was such a thing or that you were famous. Like, can you tell us about that TMZ incident at the airport? That freaking cracked me up.
Yeah, so it was our first time we were traveling together, and I don't even think at the time the world knew about us. And we got off the plane in LA, and you can kind of spot the TMZ guys. They're just basically holding a camera outside of the airport and or right around baggage claim. And I just said to her, heads up, we're about to get a camera stuffed in our face. And she's like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? And I just said, you know, just move away from me for a few minutes. And, you know, they come over and they want to ask you all the questions. And for the most part, you can just sit there and say nothing. But the questions are usually super harmless and not a big deal. So they end up leaving. We get our baggage and we go get our car. And she's basically white and her eyes are as big as any eyes that you've ever seen. She's like, so that happens a lot to you? And I said, well, and it was right after I retired, so my popularity was kind of at an all-time high. I said, you know, sometimes when you land in big airports, it does happen, LA especially, because this is where Hollywood is, so they're just trying to catch any star stepping off a plane, which is the worst, because nobody wants to be videoed or photographed once they get off a long flight. I look terrible. I smell terrible. The last thing I want to do is actually answer any questions or be filmed, so that was kind of an eye opener. And ironically, this never happened since. So it kind of gave her a false sense of what our life would be and what our life would look like. But funny nonetheless, that's for sure. We laughed the entire way to the hotel. I mean, I think her laugh was a little bit more nervous because she was like, I'm not sure about this life, but let's do this. Let's see about it.
Yeah, because she was like, is soccer a thing? Like, what is this?
Yeah, it's funny because I have been such an avid athlete and I've always watched sports growing up and throughout my professional career. And when you have kids, there is no time for that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, when they go to sleep, it's never in my consciousness to be like, oh, I wonder what happened in the sports world. I usually get that on like my Twitter feed, you know, the results the next day, but I don't even watch live sports anymore because children, their lifestyle and their schedules just don't allow for it. So yeah, I get it. I get it. If you've been dripping with babies for the last 10, 15, 20 years, that you might have missed a few of these things. Ironically though, our daughters play soccer and they're very into it. They're even more into it now that their bonus mom is a former national teamer. And so we watch those games and that's really fun for us, especially when they say my name on the television every once in a blue moon. My kids turn and look at me and they're just beaming with pride. So for me, it's hilarious that she didn't really know much about soccer, especially because Craig, her ex, played and loves the game and still plays to this day. And we used to play on a co-ed team together like a year ago. I have since quit for various reasons, but yeah, soccer is kind of a big theme in our family.
Abby, I want to ask you about travel for a minute. Whenever I work with a new writer, I always ask what's their greater goal. Because I think for most of us who are driven to write, we have a mission in our heads, right? A dream that we're working toward. Mine is kind of twofold. Mine is to remind people that they're magic, and then to ultimately help influence publishing practices to be more sustainable. And so to that end, some authors are on the road traveling in pursuit of their goals more than their home. For others, like Martha, who has a child with Down syndrome, and myself, a total homebody with like way too many dogs, we strive to make home our base. But Abby, you've said that for the 18 years following college, so the amount of time that you had been alive, you weren't even in the same place for longer than a month. So I'd love to know any travel tips you have that you used or that you currently use to make being away from home a little bit more grounded and more homey.
When I was with the team, traveling with friends was a huge thing because it didn't make it feel so lonely. Yeah. Now that I'm not with the team, I find myself definitely feeling a little bit more lonely on the road. Having a plan is, I think, the most important thing. And now I don't even have a plan because it's just a way of life for me. So I have a carry-on suitcase and a backpack that are very travel specific, and they have lots of pockets, and I have all of the things that I use has a specific place. So organization is the number one thing for me that makes me feel safe and in control when I'm on the road.
Love it.
And then making sure that for me, because I travel so much, frequent flyer miles allows me greater access to different things, whether it be lounges or upgrades or early boarding on airplanes. And then for each person, they just have to find what their specific needs are. So if you value working out, making sure that you plan that inside of your travel time, whether it be traveling later in the afternoon so that you can work out in the morning, or getting up early and managing the times in which you travel. And then, of course, coming up with a routine when you are on the road. So knowing if the place that you're staying in, the hotel or whatnot, has good food. And if not, are you staying in an area that has food that's walkable so you don't have to get in a taxi or an Uber and you're spending frivolous dollars here and there just to get you to and from places? And then more importantly, I think that creating a plan for yourself in terms of what you will be doing on the road. I can very easily get lost in a season of some television show which puts me off in a direction where I'm not doing my work and I'm not reading my books and I'm not doing the things that actually serve me and fill me up with life rather than spend my life force and my life energy. And so figuring out what priorities you have that fill you up and the things that you do when you are at home that make you feel good, and somehow trying to find ways to replicate those life force feelings when you are on the road. Because at the end of the day, it's still hard. You're still going to be tired or jet lagged or uncomfortable, or the pillows are just not the correct fluffiness. So there has to be an easy nature about traveling that I have. But the understanding that it's still difficult and it's still hard on the body, it's still hard on the soul. So I always like to give myself one full day of nothingness when I get home to do anything that I want. It's like my little gift to myself for the time that I just had to go spend on the road, whether it be through work or my philanthropy or activism.
I love that. I do that same thing. I give myself a zombie day all the time. Martha, do you have any travel specific things that make you feel good?
Well, I think being up physically, if you're going on an airplane, there's this weird psychological thing about being up high. It's a great time to evaluate where you fit in your life and where you want to go. For some reason, that physical ability to look down over a wide span makes me more able to say, okay, where am I and where do I want to go? Nice. So I try to treasure that, even though, as Abby said, it's always hard.
Yeah. I want to talk about seclusion a bit. Martha and I talked with Glennon about this on that show, about how getting away from society can be really valuable in being able to hear yourself. And Abby, you write about needing to hibernate. And in the past, you used hibernation as a way to rebel against soccer, the only way for the grind to be bearable at sometimes for you. So I want to ask about now, you know, do you still hibernate, and or has it become more balanced?
I think that Glennon and I go on vacation, her and I, just twice a year. With children, it's harder to do any sense of hibernation. There's usually always some soccer practice to drive to. When they go to school for those hours during the day, that feels like a good time. But unfortunately, I do quite a bit of work, whether it be on the road or at home. It feels like I'm always on the phone, doing calls, doing interviews. And the hibernation, for me, is important when we have big things happening. So I'm going on this book tour next week and I'll be on the road for 2 or 3 weeks. And so after big periods of work time where we have to concentrate a lot of energy into one thing, usually Glenn and I will go on a trip afterwards that allows us to rejuvenate, allows her and I to reconnect. And in my favorite fashion, allows us to hit the spa and get an obscene amount of massages in a 5-day period of time.
Power massages. And
yeah, I think it's important. I think it's important for not just the human and the individual, but I think it's important for our marriage because we do find ourselves out in the world giving of ourselves a lot. And you can only do that so much before you lose steam or you give too much of yourself. And we find that to be very true. So yeah, we manage that as best as we can. And, you know, we're not perfect by any means, but we still are trying to find the right balance between how much we give of ourselves and then how much we have to replenish after some of those big time periods in our years.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever live in the middle or is it just all or nothing? Either you're resting or hard on work?
Well, I think that we live in the middle all year, but there's usually one or two times a year where it's amped up quite a bit. So we're constantly working. Glennon's always constantly creating. And so getting those periods, those two vacations away where we can unplug and, you know, we don't get on our phones, we stay off of social media. Those are life-saving, life-force-filling times for us to like re-energize and refuel for the next 6 months.
That sounds heavenly. An actual vacation off your phone. I think if I said to my fiance next time we go on a trip, hey, I'm going to leave the phone at home, I think he would be so happy.
Actually, I was just listening to Digital Minimalism, a book on tape. It's important to figure out what your relationship is with your screens, whether it's a phone or a television. I currently believe that social media and our phones right now is the modern form of the tobacco industry.
I was thinking,
I think we're going to find out.
Go into your pocket.
Yeah, we're going to find out in not very long that some of these behaviors, these addictive behaviors, are really inhibiting us from becoming the people that we were meant to become. And so we, Glenn and I, really have to check ourselves quite a bit because so much of our work is done in online space. So hiring people to manage our social media is probably on the horizon for us. And it's not to say that we won't be contributing personally, but being able to step away for a week and not fearing any negative downward slope trend of our work, because being that our social media platforms have an impact on the work that we get to do in the world, it's something that we have to manage. But long-term stuff, we want to make sure that we aren't at the mercy of this cell phone, this device that takes our attention. And when it takes our attention, then I'm saying yes to this phone and I'm saying no to Glennon, the human being sitting next to me. And I think that that will be a huge deathbed regret of a lot of people over the next 50 years. I think I spent more of the last 20 years of my life on the phone than I did in actual communication and interaction with real life people.
Oh, you've just inspired me. When I met my fiance, I did put the phone away in the evenings because I thought, God, how rude. I would never be paying attention to my phone while I'm with him because he works all day. I have all day by myself. So I'm going to commit to that. I'm going to put the phone down at night now. I'm going back to that.
Yeah, and put it somewhere that's really away. Don't put it in a place where you see it.
I hear you.
Put it in a drawer.
I'm excited.
And just try it for a month, right? Try doing this. Like nighttime, putting your phone away for 1 month and see what happens. And guess what's probably going to happen? You're going to get confronted. You're going to have some emotions rise to the top, like frustration. And just so you know, that's the beginning stage of detox. And they're common feelings. Like just remember, you have formed a spiritual habit of checking your phone for whatever reason. And it takes time to actually break that habit. So just be prepared.
I'm excited. Thank you. I mean, it's a little challenging. You know, we live in a fire zone. So what was really painful about the last couple of years here in LA with all these wildfires is I used to turn it off after dinner. And then, in fact, this is how the habit got back into my life. You have to be able to hear the phone in the likelihood that you'll get an evacuation. So I'm really, really going to have to figure this out because I do want to turn it off and I do want it to
Well, you know what? We've been talking about standing up for yourself and leaving yourself and claiming your own space. I don't check my phone for weeks sometimes. And let me tell you, people will be upset. Just know that when you take a little fasting from your devices, you're going to run straight into a social norm that says we're supposed to check them all the time. And if I hadn't already realized that I do not care what people think, I would feel really horrified in checking my phone continuously. But I've tried it both ways. I like not checking my phone. Yep. And I apologize right now to all my friends because they think I hate them.
Yeah, I love it.
Sorry.
Of the three of us on this call, we've got a Harvard professor and, two college dropouts. So, Abby, talk to me about how it felt standing in front of that Barnard graduating class, delivering that amazing commencement speech that I was spellbound by. The instant it went viral, I saw it, as did so many millions of other people, and it ultimately became this book. So when you yourself hadn't graduated, how did it feel donning that cap and gown for that commencement speech?
Two things can be true at the same time. One, I felt like a fraud. When President Bylock, the president of Barnard, emailed me, I actually Googled whether that was the person that was the president of Barnard because I wanted to make sure that they had the right person and it wasn't like a spam or a prank of some sort.
That's awesome.
And I think that as I thought about whether or not I wanted to do this commencement speech, I really did feel like, okay, I'm scared here. Number one, I haven't graduated from college. So what do I have to offer to these women? These women who are going out in the world, what could I actually say that would impact them? And that's where my wife kind of came in and helped me understand that people have many different roads. And it doesn't mean one road is more successful than others. The reason why people go to college right now is because they think that that's going to be the easiest road to getting a good job after college. And that just wasn't my road. And looking back, I think I very much made the best of it. I did promise my mom that I would go back to college and get a degree at some point. And the other thing that can be true at the same time is that I had a deeper knowing about where we were in the world, kind of a weird time. The election happened and it feels like every single day there's a fire that needs to be put out, whether it be on social media or on television, on the news. And I just feel like that period of time was important for me to figure out what I know. I go around the country now and I do speaking engagements, and that's kind of how I start a lot of my speaking engagements. It's just asking a simple question to folks. What do you know to be true? And not to be confused with what is your truth, but what do you believe? Because I think that at the end of the day, we all get so overwhelmed with whatever we're reading and the news and your social media platforms, and it gets confusing to remember or know what it is in fact you believe, because all the AI and all the marketing campaigns that are out there, there's so much subconscious and subliminal information that's getting put out into the world. We forget what we believe. And then the next step is to try to remember how we came to this belief.
My father actually was the one who helped me on his deathbed to change my belief about college, because I really felt guilty. I felt like I hadn't finished. I only had 3 classes left. What the hell's wrong with me? Why can't I just go back? Sure, I wanted to be an entrepreneur and there were reasons I quit school ahead of time, but God, just go back, Linda. He was on his deathbed and I was going to give him that gift. And he said, no. He said, look around. I called him from Tommy Trojan, bawling my eyes out on the USC campus. And he said, look around. He said, how many of those people do you think will graduate? And, you know, there's thousands of people there. I don't know. And I said, probably most. And he goes, okay, but how many of them are going to write books that are going to change people's lives? He goes, don't do this for me, Linda. I get wanting to go back, and I may still go back just because, but Have you changed your idea, Abby, about what the belief is inside of you about a degree or no degree?
Yeah, that's the most important thing. Because I think from the perspective of pleasing others, of course, I would want to go back and honor the promise that I made my mom. Do I think going back and getting an education and completing my college education is going to change me in drastic ways? Probably not. Like, I'm pretty well baked at this point. But what I do believe on a real simple basis is, do I look at the value of completing that task and do I equate that with my worth? For me, that's the decision. So if I believe completing that task is going to fill me up with more self-esteem about that task, not about the actual going to college, about completion of something, then I will eventually go back and do it. But if those two things, if my worthiness is not bound up all in a college degree, then I might not ever do it. And that is also okay. You know,
absolutely.
I think that we have to figure out where we all individually stand on the stuff that moves us. I find that to be the case in the way that I'm relearning how to work out in a post-professional sport world. Like how the relationship I have with my body and all this external motivation that allowed me to play at such a high level for so long. And of course, there was some internal motivation. But what I'm realizing now is the internal motivation and the self-discipline component has so much to do with my own personal self-esteem. So if and when I do complete a college degree, it'll be only because I want to draw myself closer to that self-esteem and that self-worth that for whatever reason is tied up in this promise I made to my mom, you know?
Yeah, I so hear.
Could I butt in here? Could I butt in here? Someone has a butt degree.
Oh, yeah.
The first thing is, I feel like the reason I got 3 Harvard degrees is so that I could say to everybody, this is bullshit. You do not need it. I've been to the mountain. Trust me. What I always tell people when they're starting to write or starting to be coaches or whatever it is that if you went to a cordon bleu school and became a 5-star chef and told me, look, I got this credential, I would be impressed. And then if you gave me something you cooked and it tasted disgusting, I would not care about your degree.
Yeah.
And nobody in any college institution can give you what you need to contribute to the world, which is a genuine message, which is what Abby's been talking about and what she's been doing.
Yeah.
And what I've observed watching people over the years is that if you have something important to say in the world, the universe will give you an opportunity and a platform from which to say that. So for me, it was a bunch of degrees. And I remember when I had 3 little kids and I was super sick and I was trying to get my PhD, and I just remember saying to the universe, I guess if God needs another PhD, it can happen through this body, but I'm out. This is so stupid. And it just happened anyway. But that gave me my ticket to say things and have people go, oh, she went to Harvard. And Abby got a ticket by being this superstar athlete. And now she has hordes of people who are going to pay attention to her message.
Yeah.
So it's just a ticket to your mission. And it does not have to be a college degree. I think it's an antiquated system that needs to, frankly, be minimized.
Oh, I love that, Martha. Martha, you said, I remember something in Expecting Adam, and tell me if I got this right, but you wrote about how interacting with your Harvard professors was at some point like being slapped and they were putting you down and you feel like crap. But then there was that moment, do you remember that story? There was like a Smurf pool, you were at a party. What happened?
Yeah, I was actually going to a seminar, and believe me, I got slapped every day at Harvard, and I actually kind of liked it. It was part of the challenge, and unfortunately, what Harvard taught me most of all was to slap back, and I have had to unlearn that. It is not productive. But yeah, I was going to a class, and I had a friend who was in the psychology department upstairs, and I went upstairs, and she was swimming rats around in this kiddie pool with Smurfs on it, with electrodes in their brains. I don't know what, maybe she was making soup or something, I don't know. Anyway, I went downstairs and I was a little late to this seminar where there was this special professor who'd flown in for it, and there were all these really top level minds in their discipline. And I came in and I was late and I was so embarrassed and I'm so sorry. I was upstairs watching the psych people swim rats around in a Smurf pool. And none of them knew what a Smurf was, a little cartoon character. But they thought, I figured this out, they thought that I was talking about something like a Skinner box, which is B.F. Skinner's famous box that he used to train pigeons. They thought it was the name of a scholar and his pool. So they all started talking about Smurf and his great work with rats in pools. And had we read his latest monograph or whatever? And I just led them on. I was like, yeah, yeah, he's really got a breakthrough. I mean, it was just bullshit, you guys. And if you can get reading Abby's book and it says something in one page that she's learned from many, many years of incredibly hard work and thought, it's worth 10 Harvard degrees. It's worth 1,000. Oh, you don't need it.
I love that.
Mm.
Oh, I hope all the people who didn't finish college or didn't start college can breathe a little easier right now. And if you're in college and you're getting your degree, more power to you too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Just bake delicious things.
I put my kid through college. I made him. I was so obnoxious. I was like, you are not going to drop out of college. I'm not going to have you drifting the streets, because some kids are self-starters and some kids aren't. And I knew that my child at that time in his life needed structure around him. And he still to this day thanks me profusely for making him finish college. It was such a good experience for him. So to each his own.
Cool.
Whatever
book you wrote.
Yeah.
All right, Abby, we're going to do a quick Q&A. It's the rapid fire. Martha.
Let's do it.
All right, you ready? Okay.
I am.
Two. Suicide runs or a nice jog around the park?
Oh, now that's so funny. My initial reaction is of my former self, of my professional sports. Right now, it's just a jog. I go for jogs. That's what I do for working out.
Good answer. Okay. Red Bull or green drink when you need the energy?
Red Bull. Literally, it's in my hand right now.
No way. Uh-huh. Something never changed.
Yeah.
Scoring the goal or making an assist to someone who can get the shot and win?
Scoring the goal. Scoring the goal for sure.
Excellent. Yeah. What's the hardest thing about being a bonus mom?
Truth. Hardest thing about being a bonus mom is there's this biological nature that Glennon has and Craig has with these children, and they've been grooming that for all of the lives of our children. And so though I feel completely committed to our family and completely in love with these children, there is a moment when something happens that feels, that comes down on these kids, that is hard and is sad. And there's a leaning in from them to one of their biological parents. Now, I'm sure over time that will change on some level. But for me, that is, as a bonus parent, and I know that a lot of step parents out there might have a similar feeling. And it's not a left outedness, but it's this blood DNA genetic connection, a biological connection that these children have that I envy in Glennon and in Craig. And it's sometimes hard for me as a human being who's fallible and has emotion, hard for me because I wish that sometimes that they might want to lean into me too.
Great answer. Hmm. Wow.
Maybe in time. What's the most surprisingly wonderful thing about being in your blended family?
I think that the most surprising thing, it happens every once in a while where your kid does something. For instance, Tish, she was trying out for a solo in her choir a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And she was excited and she tried out for it and she was nervous and she didn't know if she was going to get it. She ended up not getting it. And like kids do these days, they text the information. I didn't get it. And she was upset. And I just responded like, baby, I'm so sorry. I'm sure that this, you know, I don't know exactly how it feels, but we're here with you and however you want to deal with this. And she just wrote back, I'm going to turn this failure into the best thing that ever happened to me. And there's these brief, beautiful moments that I could not have ever thought. Like, these kids are human beings and they're going to be future adults. What we do with them matters, and how we lead them into their own future self will have impact one way or the other. And to have this impact that is actually taking hold, that I know deeply in my bones, that is going to make them better adults and more fully who they want to be, And to know that some of the language that they use around their feelings has had something to do with my work and what I'm trying to put out into the world. There are these moments where you see a little bit of yourself in them. I didn't know that that would be the case, especially being this bonus mom. I didn't know how much value I would take out of kind of rearing these children. These beautiful little souls are creating little versions of themselves. And every once in a while, it just becomes very clear that what you're doing is important and what you're doing is changing things for them. So yeah, that's one of the things that I love the most.
Cool. You've talked about Abby having different aspects, and one of them is chill Abby with the bad habit and the shaven head. Does she still show up every now and again?
You know, it's so funny that you asked this, because today is my 3rd year anniversary of sobriety.
Whoa! Happy birthday!
Woo!
Thank you. And, you know, Glennon woke me up this morning with coffee in bed and singing happy birthday song to me. And I think maybe about 4 or 5 months ago, I looked at her and I said, you know what's so great about sobriety is that I am actually really proud of myself, because though I can go into a self-loathing place and I can feel like an imposter or a fraud on different levels, this sobriety thing has really made me feel proud of myself, truly proud of myself, fully, completely. Though I'm always going to be working at becoming a better person, I think that I have really figured out the vices in my life that I do not want to put any energy towards, because they don't fill me up with that life force that I was talking about. And I'm proud that I'm only focused on the things that fill me up. And that's not to say that I don't have a slice of pie every once in a while, but for the most part, I am living a complete sober life. And because of that, the pride and the way that I feel about myself has completely changed. So there isn't the kind of darkness or sadness that I was consumed with while using. And because of that, I just feel great. I feel great about myself.
That's fantastic. Okay, next question. When you sit down with a good book, is it a paper book in your hands or is it a book on tape? And do you necessarily?
Totally a book on tape. Yeah, it's a book on tape. I'm just starting right now the process of figuring out how to enjoy reading more. Like, I love the content inside of books, but I'm a very slow reader. And I don't know if this is completely true, but I had an ophthalmologist tell me that I'm nearsighted in one eye and farsighted in another eye, which kind of puts my brain at odds with each other. So a lot of times I fall asleep when I read. So I'm starting the very long process of trying to figure out how to truly enjoy sitting down and reading. And it's been really cool because, you know, Glennon is a massive reader, but what has truly pushed me to want to do this is watching how much my children love to read. And I envy that about them. And so I'm going about, and hopefully it doesn't take too long to start enjoying reading, but I want to truly be able to sit still and read. So I'm starting with 30 minutes a day, and I play golf and I go on runs. So I'm listening to books on tape quite a bit. So I'm getting the information. And then the other side of it is just the comprehension, the skills that maybe I wasn't necessarily completely taught as a young child. Being the youngest of 7, I think that that had an impact and role into how many books that I really was put in front of as a young kid. And that obviously slows your process of being able to see words, see sentences, and to consume the books that I'm interested in consuming. It's just I can't stay awake for more than 20 minutes. And so it takes me a year to read 3 books. It's so frustrating. So yeah, I definitely choose books on tape right now, but my hope is that in no time I'll be consuming books in different ways.
I love books on tape. And if you guys want to hear Wolfpack on tape, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
The last question. Linda had Candace Bergen on the show and asked for her favorite cut down from a troll on social media. It was a guy calling her tired ass honky ho. So this is Linda, not me, asking, what's your favorite insult?
That's good. Well, my insult is great because it is true and also a good, strong memory. So back in 2016, and the reason why I got sober is I got pulled over for a DUI. So anytime I kind of opinionate on Twitter about something, somebody who doesn't agree with me will oftentimes respond with, "Oh, how was that DUI?"
So, oh my God.
It's a statement of truth. Yes, that definitely happened. But the other side of it too, for me, is making failure my fuel. I wanted to make sure that that was the most important moment that for me that could send me into a better future that I could envision for myself. So that's usually what the trolls in my life say, like, "Oh, what do you know, you drunk?" It's like, well, yeah, that's true. Good job. Good job.
Yeah, good job. That's so creative. Talk to me, Abby, about being on stage at the ESPYs. You're receiving their Icon Award to a nationally televised audience. You're standing with Kobe Bryant and Peyton Manning, also getting the award. As Justin Timberlake described the lengths that the three of you were willing to go to in your careers, he shows footage of your bloody head getting stapled during a game. And with shock and awe, he says, "They stapled her head." Okay, can you share what was going on in your mind, both then and then, wow, when you walked off that stage?
Well, if you could find a moment in your life, that before and after moment that changed everything for you,
yeah,
that's what this moment is for me. And the before part, and I'll try to explain it, standing on stage with these other icons and just feeling nervous because I've got to say my lines and feeling excited about being given this award and humbled by the fact that ESPN would want to put me on the same playing field, so to speak, as Kobe and Peyton.
Yeah.
Some of the most revered athletes that have ever played the game. They're putting me in the same avenue, in the same lane as them. Wow, I'm just standing there feeling so grateful. And our set ends and we walk off stage. And I remember having this moment of real clarity. I think that being on stage is one feeling, and then walking off stage and getting back to my hotel room that night and really trying to sit with myself and my feelings and truly understanding, wow, something just big happened. And I don't know exactly what it was, but I'm really pissed off right now. truthfully, like, I was just so, what should have been, or I guess I don't want to shit all over myself, but what should have been maybe one of the most exciting nights of my life,
mm-hmm.
really seeing it for what it is. And I realized that night that I spent most of my career just being grateful. And that was the night that I realized, you know, all three of us were walking into very different retirements. Obviously, the big difference is how much money these guys were able to make. You know, their hustling days were over, mine were just beginning.
Wow.
And this real understanding of, okay, first and foremost, why was I so grateful to be on that stage? Why didn't I, until afterwards, why didn't I understand that that gratitude is a huge part of the problem that women find themselves in? Because we are given fewer seats at the table, we are given less money. And so when they are offering us something, like we didn't earn it or anything, I spent my whole career doing the same shit that they were doing. I earned every single award that I got.
Yep.
Why wasn't I compensated even in a fraction of a similar way that these guys were? This anger was kind of the starting place for me that kind of set me off in the direction that I've been on for the last 3 years. My role, my job is to make sure that no player under the similar circumstances that I was under retires and has that feeling. No female athlete should retire and feel that they're only made to be able to feel grateful. And women inherently want to express that gratitude. Women inherently want to be appreciative of the goodness in their life. But the other side of that coin that's so important is that women are allowed to be grateful and also demand what they deserve. I earned that award. I earned that Icon Award, and I also deserved to be paid more. But when I was inside the institution of playing professional soccer, I was too afraid to maybe speak up and ruffle the feathers And what I thought at the time is I was doing my part. I was doing enough, but it wasn't. It wasn't enough because I had that moment. So that big moment for me set me on course. And here I find myself years later fighting for women's rights and an activist and an author and a speaker and somebody who is trying to not just use my voice, but actually insert myself inside of corporate culture, because I believe corporate culture sets so much of what we see, what we consume, and what we know to be true about society at large. So my role is trying to fix all the pieces that I have passion for, the things that I see that are missing. And now it's kind of serendipitous because the women's national team just filed a lawsuit against U.S. Soccer a couple of weeks ago on International Women's Day. And my first thing is I've texted all of my former teammates and I'm like, look, if there is something that you're afraid to say because of retribution, mm-hmm. because you might lose your position, because you might fear not being able to make your mortgage payments at the end of the day, I know what their financial structures look like. I get it. If you're afraid to do it, I'm here. I'm able to. I'm no longer inside of that institution. This also leveled the playing field in my own mind and my own ego about who I was. I have lived a privileged life being on the women's national team. I've been able to get into many situations where not many people could find themselves. I've been offered seats at tables. I have been, in certain ways, the token chosen one. And still, I am not completely treated equal. And so this leveled the playing field for me and made me know that my story is every woman's story. And I think that though I played professional sports on the grand stage, this is every single woman's story in every city, in every state, and every country around the world.
Wow.
And your company, you formalized that. Say a little bit, Abby, about your company and how it's paving the way for women who maybe aren't off the start.
Yeah. So my company called Wolfpack Endeavor, we basically go into the...
That is such a good name.
Thank you. We go into the corporate world and we have partnered with companies that want to take a more innovative approach to their leadership programs. The leadership development space is completely broken. It's antiquated and it's made by men and made for men. But what has been underestimated in the process for a lot of these companies is they think that leadership is a one-size-fits-all department, and it's just not. So we are inserting ourselves into these companies and teaching women athletic mindset, champion teammates, and creating your own pack inside of these institutions. Because what I have found through my life is having been a part of a team, having had my own wolf pack essentially throughout my whole life on teams, I have been able to achieve greater levels of success because I've been able to share that responsibility. Because I've been able to pair my strengths with somebody else's strengths and pair my weaknesses with somebody else's weaknesses. And essentially, that is what leadership is. Leadership is about taking a group of people from where they are to where they ought to be. And so for me, I have been able to pair my passion and my experience and my skill to formulate this business and to go out and to one company at a time, try to change the cultural structures that have been in place for time immemorial and create these Wolfpack-like teams around the world so that women everywhere feel the support that they need and the invitation that they need to step into a higher, more beautiful version of who they think that they could be. I believe that women in leadership is the very thing that has been missing from our social culture that can lead us into a more positive, beautiful future. I look at the New Zealand Prime Minister and her leadership through the mass tragedy that happened a few weeks ago and how different that might have gone had it not been for the fact that she was this woman who was empathetic and compassionate and took on a total different form of leadership that I think is undervalued and not allowed for expression at the highest level. And so my job is to go into these corporate structures and essentially allow them the understanding that women will help not just your bottom line, but help you be a more true version of a company that you wish to become. If your products are going out to the masses, then you have to have representation at the top from whoever's consuming your products. And that's just, that has to be the case.
No doubt. Abby, when you were in high school and college and playing soccer, when I was growing up, women's sports were barely available. And then there was this huge surge in the popularity of women's soccer. And I kind of blame you for that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you feel like you were bringing the whole nation's, well, the whole world's attention to women's soccer yourself personally. Did that feel like part of your mission?
So I am a huge proponent in remembering who and what allowed me the access to the career that I was able to have. I stood on the shoulders of giants. We have to go all the way back to Title IX, which is the law that was enacted in 1972 mm-hmm. that made federally funded institutions equally give the same amount of resources to men and women. The reason why that actually started was because women wanted to have the right to go to medical school. They wanted to have more equal access to education. So the law that was enacted, a byproduct of that was women's sports in the college world. So for a college to become compliant, they needed to offer the same amount of scholarships to women as they were offering to men. And so you see over the past 40 plus years, a real increase in not just professional sports, but the increase of women playing sports at a young age, because there's an idea, a possibility that some of these women will be offered college scholarships to go and play sport and go to school wherever they get those scholarships. My career is a blip on the radar as it relates to women in sports. There are many women that came before me. We have the Billie Jean Kings and the Mia Hamms and women that I played with that in a lot of ways were able to reach across and touch the popular culture of the United States and the world at large. And so having idols growing up like Mia and then having a chance to be able to play with her during my career, during the early parts of my career, it really changed my life. It changed my outlook on what was possible. When you find yourself in rooms with women who have broken, not just through glass ceilings, because I think where we're at now, like Ava DuVernay says, rather than trying to break through the glass ceiling of a house that these men built, I'm over here building my own house. And I think that that is something that I not only am focusing my energies now, trying to build our own house over here, but I also realize that there are many women that came before me that played for the love of the game, that never made a single cent playing a sport, and have given women the platform to go on and to better not just themselves, but to continue to inspire the next generation. And as they say, if you can see it, you can be it. And there were many women out there who didn't see it, never had access to seeing it, but they dreamed of a more beautiful and more true life. And they went out and they went about creating it. And it took a long time. And it's still in the big picture. It's still in the infancy stage. But I'm proud of the progress. I'm proud of the impact I was able to have. I'm proud of the team now that is continuing on without me and without Mia. And there's no bigger fan in the world than me. I'm actually going to the World Cup this summer. It's very exciting.
And Kara?
I'm taking the family in June. So it's going to be amazing. And I'm super lucky because I was able to play at the University of Florida. The school program was only 4 years old. And I was able to get a full scholarship and go play there. Won a national championship there. So I think for all of the people who are listening, I think it's important that not every kid is going to get a scholarship, but you can be certain that there's going to be the same amount of scholarships offered to both the men and the women that are in every single federally funded institution.
Hell yeah.
Cool.
One of the parts of your book I was so inspired by was when you were talking about how FIFA said no to women playing in stadiums, but then the women's national team ignored the warnings and they were united and determined. And then they ended up selling out in stadiums. And that final game at the Rose Bowl was attended by more than 90,000 people. So it was the largest crowd to ever attend a women's only sporting event in history. and the most watched soccer game in the U.S. to date, including any men's World Cup.
One of the best stories that I ever heard was the first game they were driving into the stadium, and I think it was at one of the New York City Giant stadiums, and their bus was in traffic. And they were like, oh God, New York City traffic, this is terrible, like we're going to be late to the game. Well, lo and behold, the reason why there was traffic, and they had no idea, the reason why there was traffic is because all of the people on the road, they were all headed to the stadium to go watch them play.
Oh,
and there was just this awareness, this beautiful moment where all the women were like, wow, these people are coming to see us. And luckily they got there on time and played the game and it was amazing. But the evolution of that and the story that they told me about the risk that they took, the challenge that they crushed, those are the stories that stayed with me throughout my career. And there's a lot of different stories like that. And in my belief, you know, I'm a little bit biased, but I think that the women's national team has had maybe more impact on women's sports than any other team or sport out there. We have this unique ability every 4 years to play in the World Cup, and we've done pretty well in years past. So, yeah, I'm super proud of the legacy that our women's national team has on women's sport. And you can't continue the conversation without focusing on how important it is to have people in positions of power that take a risk for you, with you. And then when those people in those positions of power take that risk and put some real resources to marketing something, then it was up to the players at that point to not just go out and market it for themselves, but to go out and actually make something happen. So one of the parts of my book, the women went out and said, we want the ball, and also we deserve it, and also we're going to win it. And they did, and everything worked out perfect in the end. And it takes risks, but it also takes the courage and leadership of people in power to, in some ways, allow women the environment to go co-create a more beautiful, truer version of what they think life should be.
That's gorgeous. Abby, it makes me wonder, because in your book you write that every game, there would be certain times when the energy of the game would shift toward you. Yeah. And I love the way you talk about energy and how it shifts toward you. And you'd say, let's go, Abby, it's your time. And it's almost like the whole women's team before you, and then you're feeling an energy shift in a broader sense. And you definitely get that feeling reading Wolfpack, how you switch from having a team of soccer players to a team of all women everywhere. Do you still hear that voice? And what does it feel like when the energy shifts that way? And when do you still say that to yourself? Let's go, Abby, it's your time.
Well, it's definitely very different because, like I talked about in the book, that whether it be the statistics of the situation proved that I was more likely to score a goal, or the ball was more forward on the field and it was more or less my time to get involved in the actual play, it's more interesting, the transition from playing to not playing, trying to figure out what those game situations are in my current life. For instance, I'm a professional speaker. Obviously, I've written this book, so you can classify me as an author, although that's a label that I'm still struggling to say out loud with truth and with reality. I'm a business owner. I run soccer camps. And finding those specific in-game feeling moments, it's harder because it was so easy in a 90-minute period to know when the energy shifts. For me, it's sitting at the dinner table and a conversation is happening. And one of our daughters talks about something that happens at school. And it's this complete amazing thing that she's talking about. It's this teachable moment. And that energy, I can feel it actually coming into me going, oh, this is something that I know. This is something that I want to continue the conversation. This is this moment that I feel this level of curiosity kind of jump in me. And I think that's accessible to every person. It doesn't matter if you played sports or not. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter if you have children or not. There are moments that rise up in every single person's day. Somebody asks you a question and that begs an answer. There's an exchange. And I think that we don't take as much ownership and accountability on these moments when the energy does shift and that the world is calling for your input or your perspective or your action to be able to have a certain kind of outcome. So for me, on the soccer field, I was just supremely confident in my skill. And so in a lot of ways, it was easier to hear or feel or accept this kind of energy shift because this was my domain. This is where I kicked ass. And I think that getting still and listening for and trying to find those moments in your life when the energy does shift and it's your time, you don't have to be an expert to offer something. You don't have to be the best in the world to have an impact. In order to change things, there needs to be a catalyst for change. And so if something in your life needs changing, whether it be a way of thinking, whether it be a body that you want it to look different or feel different, whether it be your work and the output that you're putting into the world, you want it to be a little bit more impactful and purposeful. There are moments, you just have to be able to witness them. And a lot of that has to do with you being humble and taking the moments in your life as they come and bringing a sense of humility to it. Because the truth is, nothing is that serious. We are all here doing the same stuff. We're all bumping into each other and weird stuff happens. People die and wars start and people get married. And if we can all try to look for and hone in on those energy moments where the world is asking for you, your input, because nobody has ever lived your life. Women in the world are starting to wake up and have something to say. More importantly, the things that we see kind of disintegrating, whether it be cultural value or moral value that we wish to see in the world, women are the solution. What women want is good.
Yeah.
And I think that we have to start honoring and taking accountability and responsibility into positively impacting and changing the things that happen. And it starts with you, your life, in your every single day life. You don't have to be the best in the world to engage with this kind of mentality.
I think you're bringing up really a lot about what I see in Martha. Martha, when I look at you, you embody a sense of presence and fun and humility, all these different attributes that Abby just talked about that I think allows you to really bust through those barriers. And you've created so many things in your life, so many different forms of art and so many different forms of healing for yourself, for your family, for millions of other people. So I actually want to ask that same question, Martha, is do you have something that you say to yourself when it's go time or when you're trying to motivate yourself?
Yeah, and for me, it happens when the energy is low. The times when it shifts toward me, I think I feel it, but the when the energy is low, I don't know if Abby's ever experienced extremely low energy. But for me, I really get what you're saying about it's not easy to claim authorship. I still don't feel like a real writer. And
I hear that all the time from you guys. What the hell?
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, go ahead.
And that's why I do this writing thing online and stuff, because people who are writers have trouble claiming that. And then there are these moments of intense fear.
Yeah.
And what I always say is, look what I get to do. Look what I get to do instead of go, 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 because to me, that just makes me lie down and eat Funyuns. But if I say, wow, look at the opportunity that I have here. And it may never come to me again, and it may never come to another person in exactly this way. And look what I get to do. So it switches me from fear to gratitude, and that's my magic button.
So good. That's so good.
Good food for thought, you guys. Oh, my gosh. Abby, as you say in the book, the wolf is her talent. It's her power. It's her dreams, her voice, her curiosity, her courage, her dignity, her choices, her truest identity. And I just want to thank you so much for showing us how to howl and support each other.
Absolutely. It's
my
a wonderful
pleasure.
Book, you guys.
And, you know, thank you. And this isn't my book. This is not my pack. This is our wolf pack. And if you have a suspicion that things in your life aren't going the way you want them to go, or things in your life you're starting to wake up to the misogyny and the racism and the sexism that just is running rampant, and you're a little bit scared about the conversation and talking, this book is a perfect starting place. This book will give you real life ways to be and things that you can say and things that you can think. And at the end of the day, if you do nothing but just start becoming aware of what's happening in the world. That is the purpose of this book, is to create the biggest, most widest wolf pack that we can create. And it starts with the individual. It starts with your home. It starts with the community. And like I said, this isn't mine. This is ours. And if you believe that there's a more beautiful, true version that women can be living under and in, and a society that we can be living in, this is the book for you. This is the book for your daughters. And this is the book for your mothers as well. This is a book for everybody, and I hope people enjoy it.
I loved it. It made me cry multiple times. I was reading it out loud to my fiance. We were in Scottsdale, and we drove home, and I wanted to read it again. And I said, babe, would you mind if I read this out loud? And he said, no, not at all. I want to hear it. Even though I had read it before, I started crying, because it's one thing to read it, but when you speak it to a man, it was a pretty profound experience.
And we want to include men in this wolf pack.
Hell yeah.
This isn't just a wolf pack for women. Men are a part of the solution. And
no doubt.
We just thank your readers for listening. And I love talking to you guys so much.
All right. Love you guys.
Likewise.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Well, I didn't ask Abby to howl. Maybe next time. Thank you, Abby. Thank you, Martha. I had such a good time. You can find all things Abby at abbywombeck.com and Martha Beck over at marthabeck.com. There is so much good stuff happening here at the Beautiful Writers Podcast. In the past few weeks, we've launched in all sorts of places beyond iTunes and Stitcher and SoundCloud. We're now on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play, and lots of other venues. You can even hear us on Alexa. I have been instructed to keep my biggest news under wraps for another few days, but I will be making an announcement on social media soon. So if you're not already following me on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, you can find all those links over at bookmama.com or beautifulwriterspodcast.com. You can also find dates there for my writing retreats in August, September, and December. And if you have a few minutes, I would so love if you could share your 5 stars or happy comments wherever you do listen to the show. It helps others find us. Thanks again, you guys. I feel so blessed. Until next time, write on.